context of the 2 minutes briefing. So. Okay, 9 o'clock. Okay. Today is Monday, September 3rd, 2012, and we're beginning, of course, our Monday classes. I want to welcome the students sitting in front of me, and I want to say hello to all the students listening across the wide expanse of the big world, which we're part of. Every class, first of all, my name is Aaron Rakef, and how is Charlie? How is the operation? Oh, good, 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 good. Every class has a history to it, and let me just give you the background of this class and what we're beginning, which, to the best of my knowledge, no one in the world has ever taught the material I'm about to start teaching, although for the first two lectures it will not be that unique, as I will explain. The Kollel began a formal program in 1978. The boys asked me to teach, and as I explained yesterday, and I explained this in Washington, I came up with the idea of going beyond the ordinary classes in Gemara and the ordinary classes in Yoredeya and doing something that would open up the entire world of Shas and Paiskim. And of course, it's an ongoing class. To really get the feel for the class, you have to study together with me 10 years, 20 years, and we have achieved. Baruch Rofe Cholim. And about 2 years later, 1980, they pressured me to give a second class, and they said, you know, give us something in Machshava, give us something about the Rav. By 1980, the Rav Lo Aleinu was starting to fade. And I began a class, I remember it was the only time I had free during the week because I was teaching two full-time jobs, one in for the Jewish agency, BMT in Gold, and one in Mechwala, in addition to one class in the Kollel. And this was the second class, I remember it was Tuesday afternoon, the one time I had free. And that class, to a great degree, changed my life. I began 22 years on the Rav. Out of those lectures came my two volumes, The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. When I finished the Rav, I gave 3.5 years of the history of Torah in modern times. Then I just finished last May, June, 10 years of lectures devoted to questions that my students asked me over the Baruch Hashem, the millennium that I'm privileged to learn and teach Torah. I really wanted to go back to the Rav because I'm now dealing with a generation. First of all, my own concepts of the Rav are much deeper, much more profound. I've studied much more with the Rav since I ended off the first 22 years. Number two, I'm dealing with students who never saw the Rav, who were born after the Rav started functioning. It's a frightening thought, but the Rav has not functioned since 1985, and basically has not really been the Rav since 1980. So make your own cheshbon. The average age in the Kollel is not 30 years of age. But with Reb Aaron Lichtenstein's retirement, it hit me very hard, and I made the cheshbon that there are certain things I know that, fortunately or unfortunately, look at whichever way you wish, I'm like the last of the Mohegans. I don't know many other people who spoke. I knew people who yet spoke to Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. And I don't know if many other people today walking around, functioning, upright, who spoke and learning with Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, with Rabbi Aaron Cutler, with Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, etc., etc. So I felt on the history of Torah in the United States, I have what to give, and I have to get it out of my system. So I've worked very hard. I've prepared lectures upon lectures. I continue to work on it now, but it's not for this year what I'm working on. And I want to do something on the history of Torah in the United States, Pshuto Kamashma'o. Now, let me give you a drop of personal background. Again, I wrote this in Washington, but let me tell you this story and put it into context. When I was a junior in college, which is Junior College, must be 57, let's say. So Yeshiva College announced the contest for the best original research paper on Jewish history. And someone put up a $50 United States bond. Now you have to understand, $50, 1957, was real money. And I did my research and I came up with a paper. I later published it. It's the first paper I ever published on the 1924 rabbinical delegation visit to the United States. And I have a lot to say on that visit. I think it affects the history of Yeshiva University, but it's not for now, obviously. And I won the contest. And then there was a big debate whether I could have the prize. What was the debate about? Some of the faculty members who were on the committee felt that there was no history to the United States. The Jews in America, all that has come about is assimilation, intermarriage, and how dare Rothkopf write a paper and say American Jewish history when there is no American Jewish history. And the truth of the matter is that there's something to that point of view. We'll see in a minute that Jews arrived in America 1654. Go 300 years. What the heck did they achieve? Assimilation on top of assimilation. And nothing says it better than when I was growing up, the word they used was the first seeded tennis player in the United States. What the word first seeded means, I don't know until today, but that was the expression. Who was the first seeded tennis player in the 1940s? Vic Satius. You heard the name. You heard the name Vic Satius. Vic Satius. That name is familiar. The first rabbi in the United States was Rabbi Gershom Mendes Satius. He was a direct descendant. I believe there were seven generations between the first rabbi in the United States, Spanish Portuguese synagogue, and his great-great-great-great-grandson, the leading tennis player, a pure WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, a goy gomra, not a trace of any Yiddishkeit in him, a Protestant, and he knew that he descended from the first rabbi in the United States. So there's something to be said for the faculty members who were opposed to giving Ani Rothkopf the $50 prize for that research paper on the 1924 rabbinical delegation visit to the United States. Baruch Hashem, the majority vote went out, and Rothkopf got the prize. And I remember when I got married, I cashed the bond and we needed money, and the rest, as they say, is history. So let's see the history of Torah in the United States. What is it all about? Now, the opening lectures, I just want to put it into a historic framework. The opening lectures are about the history of the Jews in the United States. So you should just have some background, have a frame in which we can paint the picture. Yosef, this is the Monday class, and we're beginning in this class. You missed the background. Always begin on time. If you're late, bring breakfast to class, bring a schnapps to class, make yourself totally at home. But we want to talk this year, next year. These fellows will have long beards when I get finished. We want to talk about the history of Torah in the United States. What happened in the United States? Nothing with nothing. And today, second only to Israel as a center of Torah. And if you listen to the Jews in the United States, they would say, second only to Israel, Israel is second to us. You understand? They really think they have arrived. Okay, the first Jews reached America in 1654. You all know America began as a Dutch colony. And while New York, the mayor of New York, Peter Stuyvesant, was anti-Semitic, but the people who owned the Dutch enterprise that sent the boats here, among them were Marranos, wealthy Jews or ex-Jews, but they insisted he had to allow the Jews in. And Jews arrived. By the 1820s, there were 4,000 Jews in America. By the Civil War, there were 150,000 Jews. By 1900, you have 1 million Jews in the United States. By World War I, 3,500,000. Okay. Who were the settlers? Obviously, the first Jews to come to America were the Sfardim. And you have to understand why. In order to come to the New World, you had to be enlightened. You had to know that there was a New World. You had to know there was a big world beyond you. You had to be a Jew who had tasted of knowledge. You had to have language. You had to have business experience. The Sfardim were elegant. The Sfardim were cultured. The Sfardim came. Then the Enlightenment begins. How does the Enlightenment work? The Enlightenment begins Germany, and it travels through Europe. It's a world before computers. It took tens of years for ideas to travel. As the Enlightenment travels, Jews learn there's a big world out there. So following the Sephardic Jews, you get German Jews. Following the German Jews, look at a map, you get Hungarian Jews. You don't get Eastern European Jews. They are few and far between. And then comes the Civil War. And here I want to say something over from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. You always have to say when you quote the Lubavitcher Rebbe, you got to be sure to say Zecher Tzadik Livracha, so no one will accuse you of being a messianist. And if you only say Zecher Tzadik Livracha, no one can claim you're a chassid, because a chassid would say Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Livracha. There's a difference. I'm saying Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Lubavitcher Rebbe, in the 1970s, the feminist movement was coming home into the Torah world. All of you know that it takes about 15, 20 years. What happens in the non-Jewish world reaches the Torah world, reaches Israel. Our problems become one and the same. By the 1970s, the world is shaking. That's when Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik introduces teaching women Gemara. And that's when the Lubavitcher Rebbe introduces Kol Ein V'Bat Madlika Neirat Shabbat, that every Jewish woman should be lighting Shabbos candles. All right? The Rebbe introduced that. The girl should light candles with a bracha. It's a very ingenious idea because lighting candles is a woman's responsibility. Minhag Yisrael, what we spoke about yesterday, Minhag Yisrael is very important. And Minhag Yisrael, a woman lights Shabbos candles. It's Kibud V'Onik Shabbat, but the Minhag is a woman lights too. Can a young lady light? Could very well be. Why not? She can make a bracha. Chinuch. The Rebbe was attacked on all sides. You don't know how the Litvisha world, and I'm ashamed because I come from the Litvisha world, but what's happened to the Litvisha world today, believe me, I am not proud to say I grew up in that world. I hope I took the good out of it and left over the Narishkeit. Och, was the Rebbe attacked? He's innovative. He's changing halacha. Women are making brachot. What is the Rebbe doing? So at a Fabreng in Yud Tet Kislev, you all know, you've all heard what Yud Tet Kislev was in Chabad. I sat there. The Fabreng began about 9:30, if I recall, and it lasted until the morning, and it went the entire night. And the Rebbe spoke, and then they drank l'chaim, and it was a sight. You had to be a chassid to understand the Rebbe. No chassid drank until the Rebbe looked at him and said l'chaim. The Rebbe looked, 1,000 people, each one is looking at the Rebbe from that angle, and they believe the Rebbe is looking right at him. L'chaim shom tov, l'chaim shom tovim. Gentlemen, you want to see Chassidus? You want to feel it? Danny, yes or no? Go take your wife to the Jewish Museum, the Israeli Museum. Walk over. You can walk from here. It's within walking distance. Go quickly, because the exhibition is going to move out. It's going to go around the world beginning in November and see their exhibition on Chassidus. You will become a Chassid after you partake of that exhibition. Oni Rakefet was there twice already, and I told my wife, you got to go a third time. I'm still not a Chassid, but Baruch Hashem, I understand Chassidus. That exhibition will do it for you. So the Rebbe, there was a Fabrengian in the early 70s, and I now quote to you from the Rebbe. I'm saying it in English, he said it in Yiddish, and he was fabulous. And the Rebbe said, why is everyone attacking me? I innovated. I came up with a new idea. What's so new about the idea? And he quoted the Aruch HaShulchan, he quoted Achronim, who say a girl can light candles, can make a bracha. But even if I innovated, he says, tell me, what's wrong with innovation? And the Rebbe says, where I grew up 100 years ago, how did Jews get their news? Who had a radio? Who had a television? News? You went to daven mincha mariv in the shul. After mincha, everyone out to get a little fresh air in the shul haif, that's like the courtyard. And there was a Jew who got a newspaper. He had traveled to Warsaw, and he got a newspaper, and he would be sitting in the courtyard and telling all the Jews around him what's in the news. Tell me, how do you get a newspaper today? Everyone buys a New York Times every morning. That you're allowed to do? To buy a New York Times? An innovation? Das kein Minyaton? That no one is criticizing? And because I instituted that young girls should light Shabbos candles and make a bracha, that they're criticizing? Fabulous. No, Morty, what does this have to do with the lecture? Ah, now you're going to get your reward for coming. This was explained. I could never understand this. But, wow, now it all falls together. The Jews in Eastern Europe, they didn't know about America. But they did have relatives in Germany and Hungary who already were in America. And then they heard that in America, they're killing each other over black people, slaves. Brothers are fighting brothers. Cousins are fighting cousins. They couldn't believe what's going on. What? A Schwarzer? You know, the attitude. They couldn't understand it. They couldn't wait for the newspapers to come. Yankel, she's done nice from America, min da haget sich. They couldn't wait. Now they're reading the news. America's tangible. America is real. It's not something so distant anymore. It's on the map. After the Civil War, look at the statistics. The German Jews are pouring in, East European Jews. 1970s, tens of thousands. 1980s, twenties of thousands. 1990s, you ultimately reach, I want to see if you're awake. It's the Rav's fault. The Rav used to mix up Kiddush for Havdalah, Lulav and Etra. You're in the middle of a Shia. Oh, ich will sein, if it's no Nova, if you're still awake. Thank you. 1870s, 20s of thousands. 1880s, 50s of thousands. 1890s, you're going on to 100,000 a year or more. What a peak. Halavai, all the Jews had gotten out. We wouldn't have had to suffer with Hitler. But by 1900, 1 million Jews, the overwhelming majority, East European. And the greatest catalyst, the greatest push that made it possible, the Civil War, the Schulhof, the interest. Wow, cousin fighting cousin over a slave. Didn't make sense. They couldn't understand it. Brother fighting brother, Jew versus Jew. And you wind up with a tremendous immigration.
If I may,
yeah.
You neglect to talk about the Tsar of Russia.
All the
pogroms.
The pogroms play a tremendous role, but if you don't know America exists, where are you going to go to? But there's no question that intensifies the immigration. But the reality of America goes back to the Civil War. It became real. And if you look at a map of Europe, you see how the concept of America spreads. What began in Western Europe goes to Central Europe and ultimately conquers Eastern Europe. That the pogroms played a role, of course, we'll come to it 100%. 100%. But you need a tangible place to go to. Okay, now we come to something very fascinating. The original settlers in America were Sfardim, they davened of Sfard. Everyone who came to the United States was religious. By definition, a Jew was religious. There was no such thing as an irreligious Jew. Yes, you could have been a phony, you could have been a faker, but Jewish life meant you were a Shomer Shabbos, you were a Shomer Kashrut, you had to have Shechtim, you had to build a mikveh, you had to have milah. This was part and parcel of being a Jew. We have endless proof that in America, they built shuls, they took cemeteries. All of you know, if you take a tour of New York City, they will show you ancient Sephardic cemeteries between buildings. It's a sight to see on Chatham Street, where you see tombstones from the early 1700s. It's among the oldest cemeteries in New York. But what happened to these Jews? And here's where America plays its role. And I want to introduce you to a volume. I write about this in Washington. And I even quote, I believe, in the text, I write how cynical we were as students. We had a professor of American Jewish history, Hyman Bogomilsky Grinstein. Welcome. Come in. Hyman Bogomilsky Grinstein. He was a very fascinating, sweet individual. Today in Yeshiva University, time marches on. No one knows the names of the people who built the yeshiva. He was Rabbi Rebel's assistant. He was the head of Teachers Institute, professor of American Jewish history, PhD from Columbia University when Jewish boys didn't mob Columbia University. Talking the 1940s, he never married. Why he never married is a story that I've lived many, many times simply advising people. He had a girlfriend, a girl that he liked, had a crush on her. I went to school with her son. I know the family, let it remain sealed. It's not important to give a name. But you know the way love works. You're in love with a girl, the girl tells you drop dead. A girl is in love with you, you tell the girl to drop dead. Finally, a miracle happens and a boy and girl say yes to each other, darf man benchen goimel and make a kiddush. But that's the way life works. Some of us are fortunate, there are two of us sitting in this room, that we married our childhood sweethearts. But we were fortunate. We were a little bit different. So Hyman B. Greenstein, what happens a lot of times when a girl rejects you or a boy rejects you, you never marry. You hate the opposite sex. It's subconscious. If they're therapists here, they can tell you cases they dealt with. I can tell you people I know. I can give you a long list of people who never married or married much, much later. It's a very sad story. Hyman B. Grinstein never married. You open up his doctorate, and I'm now citing it, The Rise of the Jewish Community in New York, 1654 to 1860. It is a fabulous doctorate, published by Jewish Publication Society, 1947. You never saw footnotes like the footnotes in Grinstein's work. What a scholarly piece of work. So we cynical students used to say that his children and grandchildren are embedded in the footnotes. And that's the way we viewed Dr. Grinstein. We never gave him the benefit of the doubt. He should have married children, grandchildren, so the footnotes wouldn't have been so scholarly, but he was a pedantic scholar. His volume is fabulous. It's based upon the minutes of the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue. Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in New York is the oldest functioning synagogue in the United States of America. It can trace its history back to, I believe, the late 1600s, and they've been in about four, five locations. They save their minutes, their notebooks. It is the only synagogue where you can do research going back hundreds of years and have reliable documents in front of your eyes. There is no other synagogue in the United States. There is no other organization. If you want to do research on the RCA, for instance, Rabbinical Council of America, Histadrut HaRabbanim, you will find that basically there are no records before modern times. They moved once, they moved twice, everything was lost. Yeshiva University until the 1980s made no attempt to have an archives and to have it organized and to help scholars. And of course, there are more important things in life than worrying about the past. But the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue kept their minute books, and Dr. Grinstein had a field day.
What language?
In English, of course. And some of the synagogues, what are you saying, Yitzchak?
In the very beginning, it was in Spanish.
In Spanish. But what he quotes, I'm quoting to you in English, that's all I can tell you. That here, you want to know what happens in America? He quotes a statement by a Swedish traveler of the mid 18th century, in other words, let's say 1750, 1760, and he talks about New York's Jews, quote, "They commonly eat no pork, yet I've been told by several men of credit that many of them, especially among the young Jews, when traveling, did not make the least difficulty about eating this or any other meat that was put before them." And here you have testimony of a Gentile, Mesiach lefi tumo. The Gentile has no axe to grind. And you all understand what America's about. The young people came there, they grew up there, they're traveling, they're in business. Back home in New York City, no one would eat pork. But when they started traveling, pork, any meat, they're Americans, they're part of the general society. You see from the entry in the minute book of Sheirat Yisrael, which reads, and Yitzchak, I believe this is the original, there's no mention here that he's translating, that one of the members of the shul was Mechalel Shabbos, whoever breaks the rules of the Torah will not be given any mitzvah, will not be considered a member of the synagogue, and will not be buried in the synagogue's last resting place, cemetery. And you see that this is a shul, this is a synagogue. They care. 1786, years later, they talk about a lion, Jonas, that he insulted the Parnassim, and he made fun of Tisha B'Av. And here already, they don't threaten to throw him out, they don't threaten not to bury him. Here they fine him £5, $5. See, time is marching on. Also notice, what does he make fun of? Tisha B'Av. Why does he make fun of Tisha B'Av? No, remember my lectures on the Besamim Rosh? Where did Reb Shaul Berlin try to cut Yiddishkeit down? Who needs Tisha B'Av? Who needs Palestine? Who needs a homeland? We're Americans. We're making a living. We're making money. New York is our Jerusalem. Why confuse the issue? Dual loyalties. Take a look the way Jonathan Pollard is rotting away in jail. The people around the President of the United States, the Jews around him, hate Jonathan Pollard with a passion because Jonathan Pollard raised the issue of dual loyalties. Who is a Jew? Where is your commitment? Where is your heart? Where is your soul? Just think for a moment. Nothing has changed. And I have to tell you, this is a real problem. Are you an American or are you a Jew? I mean, anyone who's a believing Jew has to face this issue. I often caution people, my students, when who come in Aliyah, when they go back for the first time, they want to hit every Jew over the head in America. I mean, it really is. Yet they say, Rebbe, how can you go to Lawrence? How can you go to West Hempstead? How can you go to Teaneck? How can you look at so many hundreds and hundreds of religious families and they observe Tisha B'Av and it's meaningless? You get on a plane and you're in Yerushalayim. One phone call, nefesh b'nefesh. You start the process. Rabbi Gold, you all know, cut me to pieces on Yom HaTzmut evening. The group of rabbis got together. When rabbis get together, if the world survives, it is a miracle. Because Chazal had a sense of humor. What did Chazal say? Talmidei Chachamim Rabim Shalom Bi'Olam. Do you believe that? We got together, Leil Yom HaTzmut, and the whole debate, every rabbi had to speak. So I spoke the Rambam in Hilchot Mamren, Perikimel Halacha Gimel. We have to be Mekareg, the Satma Yidden, that they're the greatest reservoir, future good Jews, religious Zionists. And Rabbi Gold said, Mekareg, the Jews of Satma, they're the biggest apikorsim in the world. He quoted the Rambam, Hilchot Shuva, Perikimel Halacha Yud Aleph, that Polish Minute Seaboard, you can be the most religious Jew in the world. But if you separate from the community of the Jewish people, ein lo chelik liolam haba. And boy, did we argue it out. And he got hysterically ripped out of his pocket. I have a copy in there of an advertisement that appeared in Bamishpacha of pomegranate. That's pomegranate. You don't even know what that is. That's in Brooklyn, a high-class Satma store that you got to be a millionaire to walk into. They charge you for breathing air. When you walk in, you put on a mask, and the food, every type of kosher product in the world, they're showing you for the Seder. We have Kiddush, we have this, we have Rechatz, we have that, whatever. They get to Nitza, and Halavai, when Mashiach comes, we should meet in Yerushalayim. What? This isn't Yerushalayim? We're not in Yerushalayim now? Where are we? Okay? Notice, he was punished. 5 shekel. That was it. Then something amazing happens. And here I just want to elaborate for 2 minutes. It's fabulous. Page 338. You have to go through this volume. It's well worth. I don't know if the volume's available. Maybe it's on some rare book site on the great computer. I don't know, but it's worth going through the volume. You see, by the 1800s already, everyone has made their peace with America. Who's religious in America? There are no rabbis. Who cares? There's no yeshiva. There's no knowledge. So you start developing a Catholic Jewish religion. Have you studied my book, Washington? Remember the debate I had with that conservative rabbi? Here, look what you have. In America, the lay person can do whatever he wants. But the rabbi, the shaychet, they have to be religious. They have to be from. And he goes in. He goes into examples. In 1809, a teacher was called to account for having eaten in a home where the food was not kosher. Now take a look. The person who hosted it was not called to account. He could be not kosher. But the Hebrew teacher? Then they tell a story that a sheikhet was accused of not putting on tefillin, and the community investigated it. Ribbono shel Olam, how many Jews don't put on tefillin? I saw at the Kulta Friday night. I'm a couple Shabbos early, but Chabad is working. We were already finished with all of Kabbalat Shabbat, and I have to give Chabad credit. They were still working the crowd, and with my own ears, I saw this scenario. A guy walks in, a typical looking tourist, and the Chabad person calls him over. You Jewish? Yes. Did you put on tefillin today? Phylacteries? The boxes? He said, no, I didn't put it on. Where you from? The guy says, Miami. You're from Miami? The Chabad says, I'm from Miami. Within 2 minutes, they embraced. He was already putting tefillin on him. But you understand, no one is mad at the Jews. You don't put on tefillin? The rabbi doesn't put on tefillin? Oy vey. The chazan doesn't put on tefillin? Chazan, they didn't care about it. As long as he had a good voice. It, when I grew up, it was reputed that every chazan, when he fell korim on Yom Kippur and under his talis, he had a sandwich. That's what everyone claimed, and that Chazan could get away with it. As long as he had a good voice, let him eat, let him drink, let him be healthy, let him be well. Zola Zagan Hashem in the Son of Takev. Let him say the Son of Takev with a good tune. But you see, this was America. This was developing in America right before our eyes. And there's the total breakdown of religious observance. So by the time you reach the 19th century, you can no longer say that every Jew arriving in America was a Shomer Shabbos. It was a different America. You could do what you wanted. It's a free country. There's democracy. And people were starting to come to America, particularly the Germans already, running away from religion. They brought reform to America. What they couldn't do in Europe, they could do in America. They could be extreme. No one could stop them. No one could fight them. No one could debate with them. No one could dialogue with them. There were no great rabbanim in America. It was a spiritual desert religiously for the Jew. Now, you have to ask a simple question. If this is the case, why didn't the Jew disappear in America? He's coming, he's accepted, he's making money, he's succeeding. And I need not tell you, the immigrants succeeded. It's one tremendous success story after another in the United States. By the way, it's the same thing in Israel. If you know the story of modern-day Israel, every wave of immigration came in, and every wave suffered, every wave felt prejudice. You felt the prejudice against you. But Baruch Hashem, the children already integrated, made their mark in the state of Israel. It's very similar to the story of the United States. But it must be said to the credit of the Jew that even if he was religiously deficient, somehow that feeling of kinship, that feeling that bonded him to his fellow Jew, the feeling of Am Yisrael pulsated within the Jew. And here, of course, we have a lot of Divrei Torah. The Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik many times spoke about this topic. And to just summarize in two sentences what the Rav said, within every Jew, there are two different elements or levels of sanctity. One level is the level, if you're born to a Jewish mother, you are a Jew. And that gives you a basic sanctity of being a Jew. It's Kedushat Am Yisrael. If you're a Gentile and you convert, by that very act of conversion, you take on this basic sanctity. Can anyone prove that I'm right? No. A Gentile lights Hanukkah candles. What does he say? Asher kedushanu b'mitzvotav. What do you mean sanctified by God's commandments? Where were you when the Torah was given? Where were you when the rabbis were given the authority to introduce Hanukkah candles? But the minute you convert, You become a basic Jew. Asher kedushanu b'mitzvotav. A gerek makes the bracha. She'asa nisim lavoteinu b'yamim hachein b'zman hazeh. His Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. All that is part of being a communal Jew becomes part of the ger. That's one level of sanctity. The other level is a personal level of sanctity. The kedusha we develop within ourselves. The shmirat mitzvot, the shabbat, the kashrut, the tarat mishpacha, the talmud torah, the gemilat chesed. This already is very individualistic. And you see, on a communal level, we're all equal. No one in this class can say, I am holier than the other person. I'm of American origins, this one is of Moroccan origins, this one is of Russian origins, this one is from Australia. We can be from all over the world and every type of background, and I can be a convert, and this one is not a convert. And on the communal level, we are all equal. On the individual level, of course, we are different. To the credit of the American Jew, it has to be said that even though religiously he lost the heart of observance and he assimilated onto the American scene, but when events happened throughout the world, it woke up his Jewishness. He felt the connection. He felt part of Am Yisrael. He wasn't totally alienated from his people. There was that communal sanctity that still spoke to him, that still was a heartbeat within his heart. Now, three events happened in the early part of the 19th century that had tremendous impact on American Jewry, an impact that we feel until today. I'll mention the three events. I'll go into a little bit detail. Maybe you've heard of them. 1840, the Damascus blood libel, the story with Switzerland and the United States, where President Lincoln plays a very proud role. And of course, 1858, the abduction of the Edgar Mataro, the story in Italy, which was the absolute final blow that Jews around the world refused to accept. Now, the story of Damascus in 1840 is simply an old-fashioned blood libel. Imagine in 1840, a blood libel in Damascus, a Franciscan monk disappeared. He was found dead. The monks claimed that the Jews killed him for ritual purposes, using the blood to bake the matzah. I don't have to tell you the old blood libel story. 13 prominent Jews were arrested, tortured. Only, I believe, 9 of them survived. Jews throughout the world spoke out. London, Moses Montefiore, the French Jews. In America, this created ripples. Public meetings were held in Philadelphia, Richmond, Virginia, New York City. For the first time, the Jews spoke out. What's fascinating is that in New York City, the biggest synagogue, Sheret Yisrael, the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, refused to allow the public meeting in its premises. Why? No good can come from public shouting, Jews coming together. Let the general American community worry about it. And what we have to do as Jews, we will do shtatlanut, quietly, the old-fashioned way. Very fascinating. So you see that that's a precursor to the whole question of the 1930s. Do you demonstrate against Hitler or don't you demonstrate against Hitler? Again, I refer you to the Silver Era by my good friend Aaron Rakefet. The whole question of the 1980s Do you demonstrate for Russian Jewry or don't you demonstrate for Russian Jewry? No, this problem repeats itself time and again. And Sheret Yisrael, which was the leading shul, refused to host the meeting. It was held in B'nai Jeshurun, which was already not a Sephardic shul, but an Ashkenazic shul, and didn't have the prestige of Sheret Yisrael. Now, what's interesting too, that with all these meetings and all these public affairs, finally, they sent a delegation to the President of the United States, Van Buren, pleading that America should intervene. And they found out that America already intervened, that the Secretary of State sent a very strong letter and America protested. But it shows you that the Jew did not have the influence that he has today, that the Americans acted, didn't even tell the Jewish community. It wasn't a question of an electoral, you want to appeal to the Jewish community, you want their votes. At that time, the community was so small that it did not play a role, and to the credit of the United States government, their sense of fairness made them intervene without any pressure from the Jewish community. But that event in Syria woke up the Jews. It was a wake-up call. 1850, Switzerland consisted of cantons. It's like different states. It was, to a certain degree, the traditional Swiss government was like the United States. It's very hard for Israelis to understand America, because America, the states have certain rules and regulations, and then there are federal rules and regulations that apply to everybody. But you know, there's you have state courts, you have federal courts, you have state penitentiaries, federal penitentiaries. It's like in America, it's a dual system of government. Switzerland was like that, even more so. And America reached the conclusion with Switzerland that they would recognize the Swiss Confederacy and the Swiss would recognize America and they would accept passports and allow travel and all that's involved in regulations. There's only one problem. In the biggest canton in Swiss, in Basel, there was discrimination against the Jews. They could not hold public office, they were denied certain rights, they didn't believe in Jesus, etc., etc. And the Jews protested. And here, they put a lot of pressure on the American government. President Lincoln appointed a Sephardic Jew, I believe his name was Abraham Pishato, if I'm pronouncing it right, and he was the American consul in that canton, in Basel. In other words, a Jew was put in to represent the United States. Ultimately, by the 1870s, the problem was ameliorated and the Jews were given full rights in Switzerland and that issue was resolved. The biggest issue of all, which had very strong lasting effects, as I'll explain, was of course in 1858. And here I'll introduce you to a very interesting volume, The Jews in America, by Rufus Liarcy. Note, does anyone have a name, Rufus Liarcy? Read it backwards. Sofer Yisrael. Yitzchak, do you know what his real name is, who he was? But what was his real name? Rufus Liarcy is Sofer, read it backwards. I don't know if his name was ever revealed or he went with Sophie Israel. Anyway, it's a very interesting volume. It's a one-volume history of the Jews in America. The author, obviously, it was a religious Jew. I certainly knew what Torah was about because it's a volume written with a very positive point of view towards Torah in the United States, and it's a very authoritative volume for a one-volume history of the Jews in America, at least the period until 50 years ago, 60 years ago. I don't know of a better volume. Now, he details the Motara case, and the story is as follows. It's a very famous story. It's in the headlines today, if you know what's going on with Rav Schechter, with my colleagues, Rabbis Heschel Schechter and Steve Riskin, right now, this very issue is making headlines in the United States at the Mamish at this very moment. What happened was the Jews always had non-Jewish maids, non-Jewish help. If you've traveled to South Africa, you know what I'm talking about. So evidently in Italy it was no different. So they had non-Jewish help, and this Jewish kid was very ill. And the woman who raised him, the maid or whatever, the housekeeper, call her as you wish. What else is there? Another word I'm looking for, someone who takes care of children. The nanny. All right, we'll use the nanny. That's a more popular word. So the nanny, who was Catholic, went and took water and baptized him and prayed to Jesus that the child should be well. And lo and behold, the child recovered. All right. She went and told her local priest at confession what she did. The priest told the bishop told the archbishop told the pope, and the pope decreed that the kid is Jewish. And on June 23rd, 1858, a troop of papal guards broke into the home of the Mortaros and took a six-year-old kid, Edgar Mortaro, away from his parents to be raised in the Catholic Church. The outcry was universal. The great Moses Montefiore, and you have no idea what a good Jew he was, a billionaire, devoted his life to the good welfare of the Jewish people. Montefiore traveled to Rome, met with the Pope, accomplished absolutely nothing. And this kid, I mean, just think for a minute, a kid taken away from his parents, what are we dealing with here? Was raised by the church, went on to become not only a Catholic, went on to become a priest, and he may have even risen higher rank in the hierarchy of the church. It is reported that years later, the Pope who succeeded the Pope who declared him a Catholic, when he was introduced to Mortaro, told him, "We paid a heavy price for you, because the prestige of the Catholic Church as a result of this act in the modern world dropped immensely." And ultimately, they lost a lot of their power in Italy. They could not send papal troops around to pull children away from their parents. Now, the American Jews were enraged. And this time, Sheirit Yisrael became one of the focal points for the demonstrations, for the outcry, and American Jews felt they were impotent. They did not have organizations. They looked at France, and France, who had the alliance where the Jews are organized, it's a body that functions until today. The British Jews, the Board of Deputies, they're organized, a body that functions until today. The American Jews, for the first time, formed an active body. It was called the Board of Delegates, formed in 1859, and it was an active body uniting all the American Jewish congregations, and they would speak on behalf of the American Jews. At the end of the 1870s, they ceased to function because the reform movement was so powerful, and they already had the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, that they gave over their responsibilities to the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. But this body, Board of Delegates, is a forerunner. The American Jewish Committee, the American Jewish Congress, this was all organized in the early part of the 20th century. For the first time, the Jews are united. Now, the Civil War brings tremendous prosperity to the German Jews. They are now the majority. They are integrated. They are successful. They are business people. I need not tell you that every major chain store in the United States was founded by these German Jews. Macy's, Bergdorf Goodman, you name it. Klein's, which went out of business. I was a kid. Who could? You shopped. You went to Klein's, Macy's, Gimbel's. Whatever store you mentioned, Saks Fifth Avenue, Filings comes later, but these were in all over Newark, New York, Philadelphia, every last store, Strawberry Mansion, I think it was called. Every last store, Germans, Yahudim. As a matter of fact, in 1872, in the election campaign for the United States, and you can check this out, Horace Greeley was the Democratic candidate. He lost, and he died. He was a good person. I've read a lot about him, and I reached out, at least from what I read about him, he was a good person. But in the election campaign, when his cavalcade, or the horse and buggies, the parade, went past Temple Emanuel, the big, beautiful Temple Emanuel on Fifth Avenue, he made a remark, a lot of money that was gained illegally in the Civil War went into building that temple. It was taken as an anti-Semitic remark against the German business people who dealt behind the lines with clothing and supplies and sold to the Southerners, and he had to apologize for that remark. But it gives you an idea of the success of the Yahudim. Okay, they were called Yahudim. You'll see in a minute. Okay. Let me say over what from Rabbi Revel. Dov Revel. We're sitting here because of Rabbi Revel, but almost no one in this room knows who he was and what he did, and that's the way life is. And I can't even work out a fourth edition of Revel and Silver. Don't ask the Akmas Nefesh I had in America. All right, I have a student who promised to help me now, but I don't want to bother him till after Sukkos, because until Sukkos, our Jews are not listening. Their ears are stuffed with cotton. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkos. After Sukkos, we get back to the real world. Rabbi Revel said a wonderful vat. Why in America today we have such Torah, and until the 1920s, 1930s, there was absolutely nothing. Now, why did we suddenly succeed? And Rabbi Revel quoted the Midrash, the Mut Yaakov Chakuka al Kisei HaKavod, that the image of Yaakov is enshrined on the heavenly throne. Why Yaakov Avinu? Why not Avraham? Why not Yitzchak? Why is Yaakov Avinu so important? And Rabbi Revel said something amazing. He said, what symbolized Avraham Avinu? What was his greatness? Chesed. Avram Avinu, Chazal tell us, the Eshel, the tent, anyone traveling, needed food, needed drink, came in, ate, drank, had a place to stay, to sleep, and then Avram Avinu would say, don't thank me, thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu, thank God, would reveal God to him. But Chesed characterized Avram Avinu. What characterized Yitzchak Avinu? Prayer. Akedat Yitzchak, going up the mountain, sacrifice, prayer to God. Yitzchak Avinu was the epitome of man speaking to God, talking to God, closeness to God. Yaakov Avinu, Talmud Torah. Yaakov didn't leave the Ohel of Torah. Ish Tam, he was naive, not part of the big world. Sat and learned. The yeshiva of Shem V'Eva. He said, where does Torah build? How do you build Torah? Chesed is not enough. Davening is not enough. You have to study. Out of that comes the Jewish people. That's why Yaakov Avinu was so important. The Shifteka, the 12 tribes, the whole future, Bnei Yisrael. He said the German Jews came to America. What characterized them? Chesed. We'll come back in a second. The Polish Jews came next. What characterized them? 100 shtiblach on 5 blocks on the east side of New York, davening, didn't build Torah. The Litvish Jews finally arrived in America and they built yeshivot. And once you build yeshivot, once you study Torah, once you're like Yaakov Avinu, that creates Bnei Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Kahal Yisrael, the children of Israel, a living dynamic reality. That was Rabbi Rebelsvart on the greatness of yeshiva university, the first yeshiva in the United States, but it turned the tide. Gentlemen, the German Jews were tremendous Balei Chesed. They built hospitals. You name it. Jews Hospital in New York, today Mount Sinai. Jews Hospital in Cleveland. Wherever you go, go to Philadelphia, Einstein Center. They built hospitals. They were goymul chesed, charity. But there was no davening, no Torah. They were Americanized. The second generation already owned the New York Times. The New York Times that influences the world until today with its humanism, its liberalism, its lack of understanding what Judaism is all about. All Jews there. Not one real Jew, unfortunately. Occasionally, they had someone with half a Jewish heart. But that's America. But let me share with you one of the frightening realities of doctoral research. Bernard Rebel Graduate School. I studied with Professor Grinstein again. I had him in college and now I had him postgraduate. So one time we visited the archives at the New York Public Library in 42nd Street. Today this may all be on the computer. The computer is just overwhelming. I barely understand the world, but what a world. I see people walk with a computer. They don't walk into the subway without checking what lines are working, and they don't go to a store without checking if it's open, call the number. It's unbelievable. And what's available in scholarship on a computer. But we're at the library, and he's showing us newspapers from the 1870s, the 1880s. And he shows us a cartoon that I will never forget. And we live and relive this problem. It shows, by now the East European Jews are coming to America, and it shows this wealthy German Jew dressed so beautifully, clean shaven, and he's standing at the doorway of his store. And walking by is a new arrival with payas, with a beard, dressed sloppily, old-fashioned clothes. And the German Jew says to the German Jew next to him, "We were once like that." And that cartoon says it all. They look down upon the German Jew. They look down upon me, upon the East European Jew. A nebuch. A lo yitzlachnik. A greenhorn. You ever heard that word in America? A greenhorn. Modern Hebrew, I think they use the word too. Yarok, he's green. I think it's a translation from the American term. They look down upon him. And the East European Jew, you got to give credit. He got very little help from the Germans. But they came in, and within 10, 20 years, they helped themselves. Hayas, Hebrew Sheltering and Immigrant Aid Society. Hayas, it's an acronym, but it's cut down. Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. And then, of course, they started to look around. Here they are in America, running away from the pogroms, running away from the persecution. America opens its arms to them. America takes them in, and their children are becoming goyim. And it hurt them. And what do you do? And of course, now the East European Jew is beginning to think on his own. He's becoming the majority. He's coming up by hundreds of thousands. We're dealing with the 1880s, the 1890s. And of course, they open up the first day school in America that catches on. You got to remember, the Spanish Portuguese synagogue had a day school. It didn't last that long. Education was not compulsory yet. But now you have Eitz Chaim. Out of Eitz Chaim you go to Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Elchanan. Out of Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Elchanan you go to Talmudical Academy. From Talmudical Academy you go to Yeshiva College. From Yeshiva College you go to Yeshiva University. From Yeshiva University you go to Stern College for Women. Albert Einstein School of Medicine. We'll talk about all this in great detail. You don't realize what a change that was for the American Jew when Rabbi Belkin opened up Albert Einstein. It changed the entire situation with the quota against Jews. They cared. Then, of course, who could dream there'd be a yeshiva university, there'd be at Albert Einstein School of Medicine? Who could envision what would happen after World War II? Satmar, Bavov, Lakewood, Torah of Adas, Chaim Berlin, Mir. Who could envision that? But they had a vision, and it takes us to one of the most difficult, heart-rending chapters in the history of Torah in modern times. We're going to deal with it in great length, but now I just want to put it into context. They looked around and said, why are English Jews so much more observant? Why is there almost no Reform Judaism in England? And they reached the conclusion that English Jews have a chief rabbinate. Why can't we have a chief rabbinate in New York? July 1888, a boat docked at Hoboken on Shabbos. The most important person on that boat could not get off the boat till after Shabbos. Tens and tens of horse-drawn carriages came from the east side with torches to welcome the first great Talmud Chacham to arrive in the United States for one purpose, to be the chief rabbi of the Jews on the Lower East Side, Rabbi Jacob Joseph. They made an attempt. They had a dream. They had a vision. It turned into one of the greatest nightmares you can imagine. And we'll go into great depth on trying to understand what went wrong, who he was, the tragedy, and ultimately some of the positive results. At his funeral, 1902, you had tremendous riots. The cortege was being carried across the Brooklyn Bridge, if you know New York, Lower Manhattan, across the bridge into Brooklyn where the burial would be. And as they approached the Brooklyn Bridge on the corner of Delancey Street, there was R.H. Hoe Company, where they made metal nails and screws. All the workers were Irish and Italian. They saw 92,000 Jews walking behind a bier, walking behind the coffin, and they started to throw metal down at the Jews. It was an unbelievable scene. They dropped the coffin, the Jews started to fight, and the police arrested the Jews, not the Gentiles. You should know that there was a tremendous investigation afterwards. The politicians got involved. The East European Jews now have votes. You're talking 600,000, 700,000, most of them in New York City, Lower East Side. There was investigations. It was the last major anti-Semitic event in the New York Police Department. RJJ's funeral was the catalyst for the police department cleaning itself up. The commissioner of the police had to resign. The whole department had to shift gears, and there has never been a major anti-Semitic event in the New York Police Department in the last 104 years. And it all goes back to what happened after the RJJ funeral. A few years later, while all this investigation was going on and the yelling and the shouting and the politicians, one of the big police people made a statement that the immigrants, who are only 25% of the city's population, are 50% of its criminals. And an investigation was done. The records reveal that in 1908, when he made this statement, 175,000 plus people were arrested. Only 12,000 were of Russian origins. Russian being a code word for Jewish. And you got to remember that most of the Jews were arrested for pushkite violations, for being open on Sunday instead of on Shabbos, for having their pushkite in the wrong place. And boy, were apologies made, and New York police became the New York police finest. Right now, if you're aware of the New York police, there is a battle going on. Who can tell me what the battle is? If you can have a beard and be a policeman. The chassidim now who are fighting to join the New York police, again, and as Israeli, I am offended by their attitude, because they can join the Israeli police and have a beard down to the floor and pay us that curl five times over, and no one will say boo to them. As a matter of fact, they will be welcomed with open arms, because you need a police force that represents the population. If I'm a policeman and I walk into Meir Shearim, I'm their enemy. I'm clean shaven, I don't have payas, and I'm Haaretz, I'm maybe Reichait, whatever they think of me. But if you have a policeman with a beard and payas that walks in, hu echad mishalanu, it's a little bit different already. Okay, that's what's going on in the police force today in New York, and it was just in the headlines this past summer. My dear students, American Jewry comes of age with World War I. And here we have to give tremendous credit. Many were assimilated, few were Shomer Shabbos, but the basic commitment, connection to the Jewish people remained strong. The fire was not extinguished. It burned in their bones. And first of all, unbelievable sums of money were raised to help the Jews who were suffering on the battlefield of World War I. All of you know that the Germans were fighting the Russians, and if you look at the map, battles were fought in Poland, battles were fought beyond Poland, and it was inevitably the Jew who got caught on the battlefield, and once in a while, particularly Polish troops, occasionally Russians, but less, would go crazy and kill a few Jews for the sport of it. And American Jewry touched to its very inner core. We, as Torah Jews, can be very proud because the first relief organization formed in America, October 1914, was the Central Relief Committee, which was all Orthodox Jews who had made it in America, among them millionaires such as Harry Fischel. They were the first. 1 month later, the American Jewish Committee formed. And a year later, the People's Relief Committee, which was socialist, communist, anarchist, and they all united under what? The JDC, the Joint Distribution Committee, which continues to function until today. And their very famous pictures where you see from all spectrums of the American Jewish community, Yahudim, Germans, Polish, Russians, Orthodox, non-Orthodox, sitting together and raising tens and tens of millions of dollars that went overseas. Shomer Achi Anochi. And here I tell you once again, I've told the story before, I published it in the Rav. Moria Rebbe told the following story. The Rav, you had to know the Rav. It's so hard to talk to a generation at Yosef Lo Yadav, Ayakam Melech Hadash. It's so hard. The Rav, Godless and Teira, Godless and Teira. His insight into the human being, his humility, there was no shtick with the Rav. He was, So Rebbe told the following story. Following the Yom Kippur War, the yeshivot were in dire circumstances. Why? Because Israel was practically wiped off the map. And whatever stock of money was being given, and stock of money was being given in the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, was going to Israel. As a matter of fact, as one who went through the Yom Kippur War, it's hard to understand how we survived until today. Because the truth was, on Yom Kippur, the Egyptians should have reached Beersheba, and the Syrians should have reached Tel Aviv. There's no way to understand, except for Hashgacha Pratit, why they didn't advance. The Egyptians felt it was a trap. You know that. They felt that it can't be that there are no troops. They broke through the canal. From that point to Beersheba, they were free. The Golan Heights, a handful of soldiers held that front until finally the Miliyum people were able to get there and function. God have mercy on us. So the money went to Israel. Yeshivot were in dire circumstances. So the yeshivot appealed to America, help us, save us. So a meeting was set up with the joint, with the JDC, we just spoke about. The joint, which now becomes the Central Relief Committee. All the other committees don't exist anymore, and the JDC is the JDC. The funds are raised by them, or subdivisions go, and it's channeled by them and distributed by them, and JDC does beautiful work around the world, Israel and elsewhere, helping Jews. So the meeting was set up, and Rav Moshe Feinstein went, the Rav went, and they asked the Rav to be the spokesman. And here the Rav describes, they come into the meeting. It actually was described by Izzy Klavan, Rabbi Klavan, the head of RCA, the executive director, accompanied the Rav to the meeting. And Izzy Klavan described it. They come into the room, and here you have these reform multimillionaires sitting around the table. And the Rav, they ask him to speak. And the Rav says, I quote word by word, gentlemen, he says, I owe you a thank you. I long owed you this thank you, but I never had the opportunity to express it. And the Rav says, I want you to know that in World War I, I was in Khaslovich. We were caught up in the battleground. It was difficult times. And I was a student in a cheder, and I came to cheder, and the children suddenly started to dance. Thank you, Mr. Joint. Thank you, Mr. Joint. Adank euch, Mr. Joint. And I asked, what's going on? And the Rav said, the Joint sent us cocoa. Tons of cocoa was sent to Jewish children in Poland, White Russia, Ukraine. The Rav said, for us to have cocoa is an unbelievable treat. I've owed you this thank you for so many years. Let me say thank you to you before I make any request. And Izzy Klavan said that the head of the Joint took out a paper. He says, Rabbi Soloveitchik, what is your request? Whatever you want, we will do our best to meet it. And he already started writing as the Rav dictated to him how much money is needed. So we can't minimize what World War I accomplished. American Jewry, Shomer Achi Onochi, it accepted with full responsibility the leadership of the Jewish people throughout the world. I refer you to my work on the Rav. I have it in great detail, word by word, what the Rav said to the Joint, as Izzy Klavan, Rabbi Klavan, related it. Let me make one more point today. Something else happened because of World War I. Until World War I, Zionism was a small movement. Who became a Zionist? I'm a Shugana. You had to be crazy. You understand? Even among Orthodox Jews. What's wrong? We're living. We have to. If you were in Europe, you had to. All right, the communists were a problem, but that's after World War I. To World War I, you had Slabodka, you had Rodney, you had Panovich. I mean, the Rav describes this in Chamesh Drashot. Was is schlecht? What is bad? What's wrong? Well, we have such a good life. What, are we crazy to go to Palestine where there's malaria and we're going to build a homeland? Well, what, these Zionists are off the wall. Suddenly we're going to become farmers. Who knows how to farm? Who knows what a cow looks like? Is it? In America, certainly Zionism had no hold. Zionism, we're Americans. I don't have to tell you, the Reform Movement gave up Zionism, gave up Jerusalem, gave up Palestine. You all know the Pittsburgh Platform, what was it, 1885, if I recall correctly. They gave it all up. Okay. Before World War I, in all of the United States, the budget for the year for the whole Zionist movement was $12,000. Within a few months of World War I, 1 year later, the budget was approaching $400,000. The Zionist movement was born in the United States, and in the whole world perhaps, but particularly in the United States, as a result of World War I. It had a tremendous impact. The suffering, the agony. We need a homeland. We have to be a normal people. We have to be able to defend ourselves. We have to have our own life. We can't be dependent upon others. And I mean, these are cliches that you hear until today. And it's amazing how real these concepts are, that until this very moment, so many years later, we face these very challenges and difficulties. Look with Iran, look what's being said here. Jews can only depend upon Jews. This was just quoted the other day. And these are people already who are not living a Torah life, but the concept of Am Yisrael remains so strong. World War I created this feeling in the United States. So when you look back on the history of the Jew in America, yes, you can be cynical and you can take the attitude, what did the Jew accomplish? Who was the Jew? How much assimilation? How much, you can call it a spiritual holocaust. I've heard that term used. You can be very negative. There's a lot to be negative about. If the Jews had remained Jewish in the United States today, there should have been 25 million to 30 million Jews. Just think for a moment. I grew up in a world where they said there were 6 million Jews in the United States. It's now 70 years later, and the most glorious description of Jews in the United States will place it at over 5 million. We don't even have 6 million anymore. And if you're looking for halachic Jews, I am willing to guarantee you that you don't have more than 3.5 million halachic Jews in the United States at most. So you can be cynical, you can be sarcastic, you can be negative, you can be nihilistic. I can agree with those professors who didn't want to award me the $50 prize because my research was on American Jewish history. If you look at it from another point of view, it's an unbelievable success story. Jews came to America, there were no rabbis in America. There were no yeshiva in America. There was no configuration to welcome them. There was no system that they could be part of. And it's very sad, yes, the Sephardic Jews disappeared. Vixatius is a perfect example. The great, 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 great grandson of the first rabbi in America. A total WASP, a total white Anglo-Saxon Protestant in the full sense of the word. On the other hand, yes, they came, they built synagogues, they Americanized, they made their peace with the sinful life of the congregants, they developed the Catholic concept of the rabbinate, where the rabbi has to be from, he has to be Shomer Shabbos, but everyone else can do whatever they want. And Dr. Grinstein certainly illustrates this very beautifully in his work on Sheiret Yisrael, on the early history of the Jewish community of New York. With the Civil War and the vote from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, people were anxious for news. What's happening in America? Wow, brother fighting brother, cousin fighting cousin over what? Over slaves? We have slaves in the Bible. What's the big deal? An Eved Knani, an Eved Ivri. And they couldn't conceive of what was going on. And after the Civil War, wow, did they pour into the States. How did they come responsible Jews? It was a gradual development. Once again, because of negative reasons, the Damascus blood libel, Switzerland, the Mataro case, which is shocking, shocking until today. Then, of course, the East European Jew starts to question why the kids are running away from Yiddishkeit. What can we do? 1886, Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. Who could dream what would come out of Eitz Chaim? It's like 1969 on Rehov HaBabanel 24. Here we are starting a new school for kids of Anglo mentality. A school in Israel that will cater to Anglo mentality. We had 10 students. Not all of them are alive anymore. As far as I know, the only faculty member who's still active in teaching. Imagine someone would tell us, out of this school, hundreds of thousands of kids are ultimately going to be educated in Israel from the Anglo world. Tens of thousands will come on Aliyah. And who knows, in 100 years' time, you'll be able to say 2 million Jews in Israel owe their origins to 24 Rehov HaBarbanel. There are progressions here. I can tell you students of mine and their grandparents, and they have tribes already. Tribes, not just small families. Kainain Hara and Chief Rabbi, United States, New York, RJJ. They had a vision, they had a dream, paid a heavy price, a lot of aggravation. We have to cross the T's and fill in, and dot the I's. But the Jew is on the map. World War I, Shomer Achi Anochi, in the full sense of the word. And the Zionist movement is born. Before World War I, all right. If you're not too intelligent, you're not too smart, if you're a dreamer, if you're a Luftmensch, you're a Zionist. After World War I, exactly the opposite. It's the intelligent person, the smart person, the committed person, the person of vision. Okay? Where do we go from here? I have a few more words to say on the general history, and then we begin filling in the details. I want to make one small addendum to what I said about the Satmar Rebbe last year. If you recall, the Satmar Rebbe's life was saved by the Jewish Agency. And I developed the idea, which psychologists taught me, that life is based upon gomlim. I do you a good deed, you do me. We pay each other back. We're interconnected. I make bread, you fix cars, I teach. You contribute to Yeshiva University, that's life. But when someone does you a favor that's overwhelming, that you can never pay back, either you hate him or love him. And I said, the Satmar Rebbe, instead of loving the Jewish Agency, his hatred, after they saved his life, only intensified. I mentioned this in a lecture in New York, in West Hempstead, and a psychologist told me that he can give me a term for that type of story, and I want to share the term with you because I like it immensely. It's called, I quote, hostile dependency. That sometimes someone saves your life, you're dependent upon him, but it's hostile dependency. There is hatred involved. Gentlemen who are sitting here, I just want to tell you, you take life for granted, you think, Baruch Hashem, there's always been a yeshiva and there's always been in Israel. And sometimes young men don't know how to value all that went on before them to bring them to this day. The state of Israel is alive and thriving today because of the Russian emigration. What the Russians have done for us, words cannot do justice. They have given us numbers, they have given us strength, they have given us a very powerful army, they have given us economically a tremendous market, and they have given us thousands upon thousands of Balei Tshuva. Don't be those who are critical. The Russians, this problem, that problem, of course their problems. What, the Americans don't have problems when they come here? But look at the accomplishments, the Balei Tshuva, the children, the grandchildren. Wow. So I want you to know you have a schut today. Sitting in this room is a very, unfortunately, a very famous prisoner of Zion. His father and his uncle, one wound up in America, one remained behind in Russia. The one who wound up in America, I taught. A granddaughter was my student in Michwala. She never paid a price. Even a small price she did pay. I shouldn't say that because she was near a bomb. 72, when a frigid air was left on Rehov Yafa filled with dynamite, she was near that frigid air. She was slightly injured, so she paid a small price for being Jewish. But no one ever said to her she can't be shomeret mitzvot and she can't read Hebrew. Her cousin, who grew up in Russia, was only arrested 3 times and went into prison and exile 3 different times because he wanted to study Hebrew and wanted to live as a Jew. And that individual is sitting right here in the room. His name is Yosef Begun. If you don't know that name, make believe you do, so the ignorant will pass as the wise. And I want to welcome Yosef to the class. Okay, now, the freebies. This is from Rabbi Hecht of Tarandai. I get a lot of material. I have to give it out to my students. Anyone going into the rabbinate, take it. It is good material. He's very incisive. This is Israel. If you know what's going on, this is Soha, their declaration of what the rabbinate should be about. This is from one of the programs, Rabbi Yeshiva University in America, where you can go and learn every morning and then go to college. It's Model Shayurim, Rabbi Chait, Rabbi Feder, Rabbi Cinnamon. Interesting to see what level they're on. This is from the New York Times. It is a fabulous article in the magazine section on the codex, on the Aleppo codex. Where are the missing pages? My wife couldn't believe it. I said it's worth reading. It's like a mystery. Anyone who's a collector, this is the Yateid Ne'aman when Rav Eliashiv died. And if anyone is a collector of valuable newspaper, it is yours. Anyone interested, these are two early students of Lakewood Yeshiva memoirs, Rabbi Przanski and Rabbi Kerr. Fascinating. Anyone who has a Chabad connection or feeling, interesting story about the Rebbe and when the communist NKVD agent held the gun to his head and what he responded. Anyone who recalls the Munkacher Rebbe and his words to American Jewry that I spoke about last year, here is the story of how that was recorded. Finally, the Reform Movement, a very interesting article, why Zuckerberg, who was raised in a Reform temple, has even moved away from Reform Judaism. Worth pondering and see if we could give better answers. Gentlemen, Sunday we pick up where we left off. It's a different world. The power of a minhag. What does it mean that minhag cancels halacha? This coming Sunday, very important material. What is a shoe and what is a sock? And how does that affect halacha? And we will handle it. I will be going into the Diamond District in New York on 47th Street, and decisions of the court, the city of New York or the state of New York, and how that is reflected in the halacha. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya.